This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. North Carolina is now under the leadership of the newly elected governor, Republican Pat McCrory. Last Saturday, he was sworn in at the old Senate chamber in Raleigh. He didn't waste any time getting to work. On his first official weekday in office, McCrory signed an executive order that dissolves a nonpartisan commission formed by former Governor Beverly Perdue that nominates appeals and Superior Court judges for judicial positions.
We're going back to the original constitutional authority granted to the governor, giving the governor the authority to appoint people to the vacancies on the bench.
Governor McCrory also announced three new appointments to his staff. Chris Estes will serve as the state's new chief of information officer. Fred Steen will be the legislative liaison. And Tony Almeida was named the governor's top economic advisor. The state's 74th governor spent the first half of this week traveling around the state and meeting with local and state elected officials to hear their concerns and ideas to improve North Carolina's economy, education system, and infrastructure.
Very important for me as the chief executive officer to have this dialogue with local and state officials on their home turf, as opposed to having them come to Raleigh.
On Tuesday, the governor made stops in Greensboro and New Bern as part of his statewide inauguration celebration tour. He spent time in New Bern meeting constituents and hearing their concerns. In a brief interview with McCrory, he said getting North Carolina's struggling economy back on track is his main concern.
I think we first have to admit that we have a problem and admit that our brand has been tarnished and that we're living off kind of a past great brand of North Carolina that was booming the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the first decade of 2000. But the fact of the matter is Virginia and Tennessee and South Carolina took some major steps in reforming their economy that has made them in some ways beat us for jobs, which has never happened before. So, you know, the last economic strategy that we can find in my first 2 weeks or week is from 1985. That plan needs updating.
Currently, North Carolina is ranked 5th in the nation for the highest unemployment rate, though Governor McCrory didn't offer any concrete solution on how he plans to re-energize the economy. During the interview, he did mention other short-term goals and challenges, such as the passenger ferry toll increase.
I think we need to come up with a long-term solution, but I'm going to give my new DOT secretary a chance to review not just the short-term fix, but a long-term solution. And so I don't have a response to what our answer will be, but I want to give Tony an opportunity to review all the options. We can't keep just putting it off regarding a solution. We got to deal with it.
During the inauguration celebration tour, McCrory said he'd like to see a voter identification bill on his desk, requiring a voter registration card or other identification in order to cast a ballot in person. While at Tryon Palace, he also briefly mentioned changes to the school year calendar.
An internal argument in our state between the travel and tourism industry and county school boards that want some adjustments. And what's ironic is they all live next door to each other. But what I hope to do is, you know, I like to give counties as much flexibility as possible, but so maybe there's some middle ground here. Mm-hmm. But it is an argument that's, I'm sure, going to open up some wounds that were just settled about 4 to 6 years ago. And I've got to pick my battles, and right now my number one battle is the economy.
McCrory also held a closed-door meeting with local, county, and state officials where he listened to their concerns and shared his plan on issues like protecting military installations, the future of the state's agriculture industry, and the ports in Morehead City and Wilmington. He also took a private tour of Tryon Palace, which served as the state's capital until 1794. At 6 p.m. on Tuesday, he gave a speech to a crowd of about 250 people at the Tryon Palace History Center.
There are a lot of people hurting in this state right now. We are still the fifth highest unemployment rate in the country, and we have people that are barely hanging on their homes. We have people that are having difficulty paying their rent. We have business people that are just barely hanging on and paying their loans.
The former Charlotte mayor wrapped up the statewide inaugural celebration tour with a stop in the Queen City on Wednesday. The official inauguration ceremony takes place Saturday night at the Raleigh Convention Center. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Governor Pat McCrory has spent the recent weeks filling his cabinet and top staff positions, and in the last three cases, he's appointed former colleagues from his 28 years working at Duke Energy. That's led some to worry McCrory will follow the same pattern when he turns his attention to four impending vacancies at the North Carolina Utilities Commission, which is Duke Energy's primary regulator in the state. WFAE's Julie Rose takes a look now at this regulatory body McCrory has the opportunity to radically reshape.
It's one thing to make a former Duke executive your top economic development aide or secretary of commerce, as Governor McCrory has done. But the seven members of the North Carolina Utilities Commission decide how much Duke Energy and other utilities can increase rates. Such requests are increasingly common and sizable as utilities replace their aging power plants. So would the governor really consider appointing a Duke executive to that commission? His spokesman Chris Walker says yes.
I don't think he wants to limit any type of individual based on any type of preconceived notion. He wants to make sure that we have the best possible people in all these positions to the best interests of North Carolina.
Walker says the governor wants a utilities commission that operates efficiently and effectively, and that any fear he'll stack things in Duke's favor is unfounded. Even so, the AARP and the watchdog group NC Warn say McCrory's Duke career is a conflict of interest, and they want him to recuse himself from the appointments. Here's Doug Dickerson of AARP.
Yeah, I don't think he can overcome that unless he sets up a process that involves a panel or something else that shows the people that this is a transparent process.
Governor spokesman Chris Walker says McCrory will make the appointments voters elected him to make. That will include naming three new members to the North Carolina Utilities Commission before July. Commissioners traditionally have some background in utility regulation as a lawyer, a lawmaker, or advocate. But to have someone come directly from a North Carolina utility would be unusual. And the seven commissioners are on six-year terms that stagger, so every governor gets the chance to appoint a few. McCrory has three because one commissioner's term ended during the last year of Governor Perdue's administration, and it remained vacant. So what do these commissioners do?
People have a pretty substantial misunderstanding about what the role of the commission is, but essentially it's defined as a quasi-judicial body.
This is Sam Irvin IV. He was a utilities commissioner for about 10 years before resigning in 2008 to become a Court of Appeals judge. Now, the name Utilities Commission conjures, for many people, a county or town commission of elected leaders with wide-ranging power to make policies, change ordinances, and accept political donations. But really, you should think of the Utilities Commission like a panel of judges, says Irvin. They hear arguments, assess the facts, and rule according to their interpretation of state law.
I used to have that chapter pretty well committed to memory, but I don't now.
It's all spelled out in North Carolina's general statutes, which Irvin keeps in hardbound books lined up behind his desk. By state law, utilities commissioners are paid $124,000 a year. That's the same as a superior court judge. And they're held to the same code of conduct.
Yeah, here we go. GS 62-327, which is entitled Gifts to Members of the Commission, Commission Employees, or Public Staff, should be unlawful for any officer.
So basically, commissioners can't take gifts from or own stock in the utility companies they regulate. And like judges, they're prohibited from having side conversations called ex parte communication with anyone but their own staff about an ongoing case. Now, Duke got into some trouble in Indiana a few years ago when email exchanges came to light showing a cozy relationship between Duke executives and the chairman of the Indiana Utilities Commission. We used public records law to see if North Carolina Utilities Commission Chairman Ed Finley had had any private email or phone conversation with top Duke and Progress executives during the period the companies were merging. Our request turned up nothing. And that doesn't surprise John Runkle. He's an attorney for NC Warn, which criticizes many commission decisions.
I feel that the personal integrity of our commissioners is pretty good.
None of the current commissioners would agree to an interview for this story. Their attorney, Sam Watson, sent an email emphasizing the code of conduct to which commissioners are bound. But Runkle says ethics aren't the problem. It's influence. He thinks the whole process favors utility companies that donate generously to the politicians who nominate and confirm commissioners, as well as spend lots of money on lawyers who make their case to the commission itself.
you know, the Duke lawyer has got his, you know, special chair and that kind of thing. So easily they have a much bigger presence than anybody else can afford.
Utilities Commission meetings are public, so Runkle and his nonprofit clients are welcome too. But they can't cross-examine witnesses or call their own during a hearing unless the commission gives them permission to participate in the case. That permission is not always granted. Usually what happens is the commission approves a settlement that Duke Energy works out with the public staff of the Utilities Commission, which is the state agency responsible for advocating on behalf of utilities customers. Runkle argues those settlements are often too easy on Duke and don't help the little guy enough.
The issues that are important to ratepayers, the residentials and small businesses and those, are just not being heard.
It's the job of the executive director of the public staff to push back against utilities and make sure customers get a good deal. But industrial giants like Nucor are customers. So are corporations like Walmart. And they have very different energy needs than you and me. So Robert Gruber is in a tight spot as the director of the public staff.
We attempt to balance the interests of all the consumers. But no matter what I do, I'm going to be criticized. There are going to be people that didn't like the outcome.
Most of the attorneys and former commissioners we spoke with say Gruber has done a good job finding that balance in the 30 years governors have been reappointing him to the post. But now Gruber is retiring, and many think his replacement is the most important Utilities Commission appointment Governor McCrory will make. His pick will be part of every negotiation about the cost of power in North Carolina for years to come. And anyone he chooses, in light of the governor's own lengthy career at Duke, will be guaranteed to attract heightened scrutiny. I'm Julie Rose in Charlotte.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Alliance One International, pleased to provide support for Public Radio East. Alliance One International, a global leaf tobacco market with operations in Farmville and Wilson. A 2012 study from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill found that some of the state's highest rates of cervical cancer could be found in parts of eastern North Carolina. L.C. Morris recently talked to a researcher with the project about what the study tells us.
Although overall cervical cancer rates in North Carolina are consistent with rates for the rest of the nation, some areas here in the east have an unusually high number of cases. According to the study, Duplin and Halifax counties lead North Carolina in the number of cervical cancer diagnoses. Cervical cancer is a potentially deadly disease with few symptoms. The cancerous cells, which start in the cervix, the lower part of the uterus, are almost always caused by human papillomavirus, HPV infection. Dr. Jennifer Smith, Associate Professor of Epidemiology with UNC Chapel Hill, cites a lack of education about the disease and a lack of screening as reasons for the locally higher rates.
Cervical cancer is a cancer of disparities, and so it actually more likely hits women who have not been screened recently, and these women are women who are generally of lower income. They're also women who actually are more likely to be uninsured. Counties that were relatively poorer, those counties that actually had higher rates of cervical cancer, it's likely because the women living in those counties, a larger proportion of those women are probably women who actually do not have private insurance.
The study, Burden of Invasive Cervical Cancer in North Carolina, which was published in the March-April 2012 issue of Preventive Medicine, examined data from the North Carolina Central Cancer Registry on all cervical cancer cases reported in the state from 1998 to 2007. There were 3,652 cases and 1,208 deaths in that period. The study found cervical cancer incidence and death rates varied greatly by county, with less affluent counties having higher rates.
What we wanted to do is actually document where are the cancers most prevalent, in which counties of North Carolina are they the most prevalent, who is actually having a bigger burden of cervical cancer in North Carolina. And the idea there was for us to be able to develop strategies to target interventions at counties and at certain types of the population that are higher risk in our state of North Carolina.
Counties that had the highest rates were Anson, Chewan, Duplin, Halifax, Hoke, Lincoln, Randolph, Sampson, and Scotland. The study found that while most cases and deaths were among white women, Hispanic women had the highest incidence rate at 18.3 cases per 100,000 women. The rate for African American females was 10.6 cases per 100,000 women, and white females 7.3 cases per 100,000 women. A greater proportion of African American women died from cervical cancer than other races. The mortality rate was 4.5 deaths per 100,000 women, compared to 2.2 deaths per 100,000 white women and 2.0 deaths per 100,000 Hispanic women. Dr. Smith says cervical cancer is preventable, even for the low income and non-insured.
We can actually screen for cervical cancer. Cervical cancer, we can screen for precancerous lesions, we can treat them in a timely way, and we can prevent cervical cancer. What's exciting about cervical cancer, it's a cancer that we can actually prevent through screening and treatment of precancerous lesions, and then we can avoid the death due to cervical cancer.
The main cause of cervical cancer is HPV, human papillomavirus, a common virus that can be passed by one person to another during sex. On a related note, changes to the childhood vaccination schedule last year drew some controversy when the American Academy of Pediatrics piggybacked the CDC in recommending boys as early as age 9 to be vaccinated for HPV. Smith also serves as the director of the Cervical Cancer Free America Initiative.
We can do more to prevent cervical cancer in North Carolina. Let's spread the word to our family and friends about the availability of free vaccines through our Vaccine for Children's program in our state, as well as screening for cervical cancer. If you are uninsured and fulfill other criteria, you can go to the National Cervical Cancer Prevention Clinics in your state by calling your state health department to find more information.
The initiative is guiding states to develop cervical cancer prevention programs aimed at eliminating cervical cancer through education, vaccination, screening, and early treatment.
But we recommend vaccination of young girls to prevent the infection. And as I mentioned earlier, we can also screen for the disease. So we actually believe that in the world and in America, there are women who are dying unnecessarily of cervical cancer. Cervical cancer can be prevented. And therefore, we set up an initiative to actually do more in several states across the nation to reduce cervical cancer.
For more on cervical cancer or a link to the study, you can visit our website at publicradioeast.org. I'm L.C. Morris.
This is the Downeast Journal. 13 miles off the coast of the Outer Banks is a decommissioned light tower called Diamond Shoals. Last October, a man named Dave Schneider bought it from the General Services Administration. Schneider wants to renovate it, make it a self-sustaining facility, and attract a community of people that are interested in using it for progress or recreation. Stephen O'Connell talked with Dave Schneider last week about the tower and his plans.
I don't know of a facility that's going to have access to the ocean and all the great things that we have there. And all the challenges we have there, there's not a lot of facilities like that. Obviously, there's a lot of oil platforms, but they're kind of focused, obviously, in one area.
I read that it's not just going to be used for your company. Would you tell me some of the work you're going to do out there?
What we want to do is focus here is be able to use this facility to be out there in the ocean, give, you know, researchers, give people that are doing maybe product development a place where they have access 24 hours to the ocean. Today, I just got an email from a university in Delaware. They want to do some wind studies out there. So they're asking me, you know, if that would be something that we'd want to participate in. I said, obviously, yes. You know, there's other people doing research in climatology, solar. You know, people are still perfecting the solar industry. Obviously, the wind, luckily, there's still going to be tax credits out there for the wind turbine that we're going to continue to have. So there's still going to be people doing research in that area.
How do you feel about the tower's location? I mean, it's called the Graveyard of the Atlantic. I imagine getting out there isn't always going to be so easy.
So, you know, that is a challenge. You know, it's kind of that double-edged sword. The reasons it's out there is because there's angry seas out there. If it wasn't the case, it would never have been there. So, I mean, it just comes with the territory that's part of, you know, the things that we have to, you know, plan for. It's not the most accessible place in the world.
When do you plan to go out there next?
Well, probably it's going to be April, May time period.
I read that you're going to be recruiting volunteers for the work. If you don't have any experience like welding or doing construction, do you think there's still a place to join in if you're just excited about this?
I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, day-to-day, you know, I haven't welded in a few years either. I'm probably not the guy I want to weld our stairs on. So, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of just general work to be done. I mean, we are going to, I need to get somebody with some expertise in solar panels. I need to get a good welder out there. But, you know, a lot of the work that we're going to be doing is just sweeping and scraping and cleaning and sanding. And I'm not sure, I think anyone could work in those areas. I mean, I don't really see this as my facility or Zapp's facility. I mean, the long-term goal is to kind of make this a community place. You know, there's a lot of fishermen that go out in that area. We'd love to have those guys out there. There's actually some guys that see kayak out there. We'd love to see those guys stop by. A lot of dive boats go out there. Love to see those guys stop by. So, you know, I think along with kind of the technical side of it, I mean, let's be honest, it's a heck of a recreational facility. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people in the Outer Banks area that have been looking, you know, seeing that structure out there for 40-some years, and they've always said, geez, I'd love to step foot on that. Well, hopefully we're going to give them the opportunity here soon.
Thanks for speaking with us.
Okay, great.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Here it is, the second week of January 2013, and I've got seed catalogs in my mailbox and my email inbox, and I love it. This is a wonderful time to start looking at vegetable seeds and deciding what you want to grow this year, because believe it or not, there's some things that need to be planted in February here in coastal North Carolina, so it really isn't too early. So what sorts of things should you be thinking about as you look through the seed catalog? Here's the list of what I want you to consider. First, which vegetables do you really want to grow? Remember, we are in zone 8. We have a wonderful long season that starts early in the spring and goes very late in the fall. Next, think about what you and your family actually eat. Although I highly recommend expanding your vegetable horizons and testing one or two new things each year, don't fill your garden with, let's say, fennel, if no one in your family but you likes it. So now you've picked a range of vegetables. Let's say you want some lettuce, some beets, some carrots, corn, tomatoes, peppers, squash. Now you have to decide which variety in each of those vegetable types you want to choose. Read the descriptions very carefully. Often, different varieties of a given vegetable will have different flavors. Some tomatoes are acid, while others are mild and sweet. So read that and choose the ones you think you might like. Look for disease resistance. Now, this doesn't mean that the plant absolutely won't get diseases, but it may mean that you have a little more of a fighting chance. Also, check out the time to maturity. You might find as much as 20 days difference in the number of days it takes for two different varieties of one vegetable to mature. This matters particularly in our area, where we can grow three different crops in one space in our garden in a year. So if you want to plant an early spring crop, a summer crop, and a fall crop, all one after the other in the same place, well, then you're going to want to choose varieties that mature more quickly so that you have time to get the second and then the third crop in the ground. Also, think about the size of your garden. For most vegetables now, you can buy varieties that are full size and take up lots of space, or varieties that are much smaller and are better suited to small gardens, like mine. Then think about whether you're going to plant the seeds directly in the garden or whether you want to plant transplants. I do most of my vegetables directly by seed. Most of them will do well that way. But if you want to hurry up the season a little bit or shorten the time period to maturity, as we were just talking about, some things can be transplanted rather than planted as seeds. Right now, I want you to get a cup of coffee, tea, or hot chocolate, put on your slippers, sit down in a comfy chair, maybe by the fire, and open your iPad or pick up the catalog and start browsing through the wonderful vegetable varieties for this coming year. And think about all the things you can do in even a small space in your yard. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.